Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, Griefsters. I hope you're having an okay week. If you are in the DDC, that's Dead Die Club, if you're new to this podcast, it is the dreaded Father's Day on Sunday. I do think we get off slightly lightly compared to the Mother's Day gang, because they find it harder to sell things to men than they do to women. But I will be thinking of you this Sunday. My biggest tip is just stay off social media. It's so much easier. And I know that's hard and you want to go on there, but like, you know, it just... there will be an advert or someone will post a picture. Yeah, so I find my what really helps me is just staying off social media for the day. And then honestly, I promise you, Monday, no one mentions it again. It's gone. No one's talking about Father's Day, Boxing Day. So that's a handy thing. I hope wherever you are, you have an okay day and it passes as peacefully as these things can at the moment. This week, I am talking to the incredible broadcaster, writer, and journalist James O'Brien. I'm sure you'll be familiar with James's work. He is a radio presenter on LBC, where he regularly tackles people in this so spectacular way. You have to watch it on YouTube to see him at work. He's also a writer. His book that came out last year is published in paperback now, called How Not to Be Wrong: The Art of Changing Your Mind. James is a very honest and interesting, intelligent person. It was an absolute joy that he found time to come and speak to me. James came in to talk to me. He has actually lost his father, which he talks about in the book a little bit as well, and about the grief around that and sort of being a man, expressing emotions and what that means. But we actually ended up talking a lot about his very good friend Andy, who died last year. So, James, who are we remembering today? We ask all our guests that.
Well, I lost my dad a few years ago, but I lost a really good friend at the age of 50 last December, December of 2020, at the end of lockdown. So, I mean, remembering both of them, but I think probably I'm 50 in January, and this is the first time someone from my own peer group has passed away, and it's... Mm. Possibly more interesting than losing a parent, which you kind of, even when it takes you by surprise, it's not a shock. You expect to outlive your parents. I don't know that I expected to outlive my mate Andy, and in the, you know, the 5 or 6 months that have passed since, it's been quite an interesting experience. The bits that come back, the reminders that come back, the bits that you do think about and the bits that you don't think about, and the whole sort of intimations of your own mortality as well, as I know you've explored very, very much in the past.
So his name was Andy. Mm. So how did Andy die? What happened?
I had a brain tumour. They had an inoperable brain tumour and got the diagnosis and the prognosis, which he defeated. He hung around for a lot longer than was originally expected. But there was pretty much from the minute that he collapsed in the street and had a fit. And from that moment on, I mean, from the first medical investigation after that, he knew that that was it. He knew that the writing was on the wall. And until he actually died, I don't know that I ever actually properly believed that he was going to. To be honest with you, I saw quite a lot of him towards the end. So obviously, when you know I'm sitting on his bed, holding his hand, and he, not really sure whether he knows I'm there or not, then I was clear.
Yeah.
That he wasn't going to suddenly. They weren't going to announce that they'd made a terrible mistake. But until that final fortnight, I think subconsciously somewhere inside, I still thought that we might somehow pull it out of the bag, you know. Mm-hmm. Weirdly, just didn't. I wouldn't have said that at the time, but I would now.
I think it's very common, and it's very hard sometimes to like rectify that in your head, because you're like, well, you know, I'm a logical person, I'm smart, like,
yes.
Why do I think that? But there's just some part of the human brain that's like, no, I don't, until it happens. I think we just, part of you sort of builds a little bit of cotton wool around yourself of like, just don't look at that too closely, because it's painful. And so, you know, I think we just sort of, yeah, it must be some form of self-protection that is just, it's just too hard to go, like, they're definitely going to die and I need to face that, until, as you said, you know, they're on the bed and you're holding their hands. And you
absolutely unavoidable, and children, yeah, as well, and all of that kind of. And also, and I often think that death and birth are, every single time one occurs, it feels like the first one ever. The closer yeah, you are to the action, you know, people have a baby, and I'm speaking about myself now, I'm not criticising anybody else. When my oldest was born, I thought that this completely changed the way that everybody should look at existence, humanity, and the world in general. And then it was politely pointed out to me that quite a lot of other people had had babies over the millennia, and that this probably wasn't a unique experience. And then when my dad died, again, as that was my first real taste of grief, again, I sort of thought, crikey, this is... And then you have to remind yourself that this has happened to everybody who's ever lived has been through grief of some kind.
Yeah.
But I don't know whether it was with the age and the unexpected nature of it, and it being illness rather than just old age. I think there is probably an evolutionary device that's designed to protect you from recognizing the futility of existence. If we all recognized mortality and the futility of existence, then none of us would ever get out of bed in the mornings, I guess. And that must be how the species has thrived and survived.
How long had you known Andy? Had you known him a long time?
Yeah, I mean, his wife was my wife's best friend from school. So we'd been, you know, couple friends for, I've been married for 21 years. So it goes back beyond that.
Wow.
All my adult life, really. All my post-university adult life.
Well, yeah, I think it's interesting what you're saying, because, yeah, you know, I speak to lots of different people, and yeah, each grief is unique, but something about losing someone, like you said, in your age bracket, in your range, and as you said, post-university has obviously witnessed all these things that you've gone through. That phrase was used with another guest when she was talking about the loss of a sibling, Emily Dean, whose sister died. And her parents, and she said when her sister died, she lost her witness. And I think maybe is that similar with a friend, of like someone who's been through those markers with you, like you said, for such a long time, and then them going is something that just hadn't That's prepared very, in your head for at all.
No, and also it's interesting that, because he worked in the same sector. He wasn't a show-off, he wasn't a presenter. He was a very, very successful entrepreneur and set up his own business doing content and TV production, film production. And what I loved about him was that notion of witness. He wasn't, he found the show busy side of my world simultaneously ridiculous and fascinating. And you need friends like that when you do this. Otherwise, if you've got a slightly overdeveloped ego, as most people do on my side of the microphone, on my side of the Green Bay's door, you need friends. I call them twat alarms. You need a twat alarm. You need somebody who will tell you when you're being a twat. If you look at some of the biggest public car crashes in politics or entertainment, they're people who no longer have a twat alarm. They're people who have nobody in their life who will just tap them on the shoulder and say, mate, come on. Why? And he didn't do it often, but I was always with a really good a really good friend teaches you to become your own twat alarm, I think. So because certainly since he died, I have on a couple of occasions found myself wondering how I'd tell him this particular story, or I'd share with him this particular, I mean, anything from an on-air experience right through to a contract negotiation, because he was, and I didn't realise when he was still alive how brilliant a businessman he was, because he was just my mate. And then I did the eulogy at his funeral on, there was a few of us in the room, and then on Zoom afterwards. And the way that people spoke about him made me realise how blessed I'd been just to have his counsel, because what was just a mate to me was a world-beating businessman, one of the most important people in that whole YouTube channel, tailor-made content sector. So Dan Snow, the historian, was talking to me about how Andy had changed his whole life, his whole outlook on the profession and other people, like really heavy hitters, really, really big names, were queuing up to share their memories of what an amazing visionary he was in this industry that has kind of grown up around us over the last 10 years. And so I was just getting counsel off my mate. I was just getting occasional sounding board advice without realizing what a big deal he was in the world at large. And that made me really miss him as well, that sense of not being able, I don't think he'd have minded because he didn't have an overdeveloped ego, but I'd like to have said at some point, I do, by the way, understand what a massive, massive deal you are. And if I'm really honest, I don't know that I did while he was still alive. I kind of knew, but I didn't know, if you see what I mean, because it's separating the friend from the public figure, and I never really got the hang of that.
It's hard, I think, when you've known someone a long time. Like, if you've been friends with someone a long time, and like you said, to the point that, you can twat alarm each other, I'm sure.
Yes. Well, he didn't need it, actually. I've got to be honest with you. And I need it more than is normal. So it's an interesting tension.
Yeah, that is. And I think it's hard sometimes. I don't know, they almost become family-like. And, I've got friends of 20-plus years and who are performers. And I find it's like, you've almost got to the point where it would seem weird to say, do you know how important I think you are? So you get to the almost like, you know. Anyway, and I think, God, when does it happen? Like, when does a friend sort of cross that boundary of,
a
newer friend, you'd be like, oh, gosh, thank you so much. Oh, you've been so wonderful. Wow. Because you want them to know.
Yeah.
But once you get to a stage with someone, you're like, it's beyond words how we connect. And, you are a part of my family, extended family, and that, and whatever happens, even if we fall out, I know I could call you, and if I needed you, you would be there. Like, that's the agreement we've got with each other.
But then you get the Joni Mitchell moment, don't you, where you don't know what you've got till it's gone. And that I have found myself being hit round the back of the head with that quite a lot lately. I don't know that I ever had a friend who delighted in my successes as much as he did, because he'd been there when I was very, very frustrated about things not going better for me, about, being stuck in a bit of a rut and wondering why, the X wasn't happening or Y wasn't happening. And so when it all started happening, he found it delightful. There was that Gore Vidal line about how every time a friend of mine has a great success, a part of me dies.
I die.
Which I used to I used to nod along with that a lot. But my God, if only he'd had a friend like mine, because that sense of simultaneously understanding its importance while also finding it ridiculous. I don't know that I'll ever have a friend like that again, to be honest with you. I don't know that people can just get it so intuitively. So he had one foot in the industry and one foot, as you say, in my family. We're each other's children's godfathers. We were knitted, knotted together in so many ways that I didn't, as I keep saying, I didn't really realise. I don't know if you can learn from this. I don't know whether you start cherishing your other friendships more or whether actually losing the friend who might well, at the end of my journey, might turn out in many ways to have been the best friend in these areas that I could ever have had. I don't know whether... I think sometimes you just have to sit with your sadness, don't you, rather than think that you can overcome it or fix it or learn from it or find the silver lining. Sometimes you just have to sit with it. And I know I told him how much I loved him. And that was the kind of language that he was from Rochdale. I mean, he found that kind of lovey crap absolutely ridiculous. But yeah, the value that people have to you is probably not something that most of us keep a running tally of, is it?
No, not at all. And also, I think grief can be really tricky sometimes because, like you said, it sort of makes you think, oh, should I cherish everyone and tell everybody, like, you're so important. But actually, in real day to life, you can't. And you said it would be odd, you know. Important.
Lots of people that you love, lots of people that you're friends with, they're not as valuable to you as others. That's what I mean about sitting with it. I don't know that I have really drawn any profound lessons from losing him in the sense of how I treat other people. I've just, with each passing month, I've come to miss him more because I hadn't realised the size of the space that he occupied in my life.
Yeah. And every grief is different and no advice is suitable for everybody. But sitting in your sadness, I think, is what you said is so great because... it's the only thing I've learned that kind of works, inverted commas. Like, it does...
You have to just accept it.
Yeah, you just can't
fix it. I couldn't
do
that before therapy. I couldn't have done that before I had therapy. I used to approach everything like a riddle I could solve or a battle I could win or a fight that I had to... You know, a foe I had to vanquish. So having therapy for me... And I spoke to him a lot about this because he had therapy after his... diagnosis to help him come to terms with things, and we spoke together. I mean, as much as a lad who was never that comfortable talking about his feelings could do, but that idea of I'd have been bugger all used to him if I turned up every time I saw him with a sort of jolly holly hockey sticks come on attitude. And although I said to you at the outset I never quite believed that we were going to lose him, I certainly never tried to, which I would have done before therapy, I'd have been trying to, you know, come on, we can, come on, there's got to be something we can do. Or I've seen Lorenzo's oil. There's always a miracle. Seriously, that's who I used to be. I thought that you could fix almost anything with a sort of weird combination of a stiff upper lip and a PE teacher's psychology. But but no, I think just sitting with him and sitting with our pain, my pain and his pain, was a lot more valuable to both of us in the end, a lot more useful.
God, yeah. And I, very similar, I can only say sitting in sadness is a good idea thanks to therapy. I'm a fix it. I'm like, we can research, we can Google, we can work hard, we can keep talking, push through, and somehow, guys, we're going to fix everything. That's like, there's always a... My dad, you know, one of his quotes was, don't give me problems, give me solutions.
Yeah.
That's what he used to all say to us. So I was brought up with this, like, there's always a solution, you just haven't thought of it. And that's what I used to do with my grief, is like, well, how can we solve it? You know, how can we feel better? And then, thanks to therapy, you've learned to just go, oh, it's just sadness. And I think that's really wonderful that you were able to sit with him before he died and just be like, oh, this is just awful. Let's just sit in it with each other. Because like you said, so many people struggle to do that before someone's dead, you know, but they struggle with that bit when it's so painful and it's so difficult and they want to just come in and just make it better and just make it not true. And so I think that's, you know,
it's also not, for me, it was also about, I never realised I used to do this, but my personal feelings would be my priority in any situation. So I think this starts at boarding school, where you want everybody around you to reassure you that there's not bad news just around the corner. So whether it was you're away from home, so you don't have that parental safety blanket in permanent position. And so I realized a few years ago when I started therapy that I wanted everyone around me to reassure me that I was okay. So if you were in pain, I'd try and convince you that you weren't, so that I would then feel better. So it took me ages to unravel this. And it's like everything else, it's a work in progress. But if I loved you and you were in pain, my pain would be bad. And therefore, rather than helping you, I'd want you to help me. So I'd be trying to convince you that things weren't that bad. And then if you then agreed with me that things weren't that bad, whether it was true or not, I'd feel temporarily relieved. I'd feel temporarily better about my vicarious or my empathetic pain that was, and I had none of that with him, which is must be down to therapy, because I could sit there and I'd think, right, today I'm going to make you laugh, and I would, and we'd sit and we'd laugh properly, and on the way home I might cry, but I thought, well, that's fuck all use to him. There's no point me sitting there crying, you know, if I've come round to take a bit of pressure off. All that matters in this engagement right now is your feelings. That was a very new experience for me. There's the timing of starting therapy, losing him, or him being ill, was pure coincidence, but it was remarkable because it was the first time in my life, I think, that I'd been able to leave my own feelings in the background, and thank goodness that I could and that I'd learned to.
So when, just to get me clear my timeline, so it was last December, did you say? So how has that been? Because that was, we were in the depths of, I think, the worst lockdown, the winter lockdown. Did you find that kind of, I know you said you did the eulogy and you had, you know, stuff on Zoom. Was that an added layer to the grief, or was it just, you know, by the by, the kind of thing?
I felt angry about the funeral being so small, because more so for his wife, actually, than for him, because obviously he wouldn't have been there, but I feel for his wife and children, a really massive send-off would have been fairer, would have been more helpful, because it was end-of-life care, and my wife and I were, you know, we were involved, we didn't get that restricted by lockdown rules, and we came in and out of it, so, you know, he was still well enough to go out for a slap-up feed in sort of August, September of last year. So I don't know, because it happened in those circumstances, and it's the only time it's happened to me. So I don't have a space for comparison. But yeah, I mean, I think that everything being slightly surreal anyway, probably then played into the, you know, as I say, despite the fact that it's happened to everyone who's ever been born, it still feels surreal when it happens to you. So there is, in my memory, there's a slightly unreal air to all of it. And I wouldn't know where his illness stops and the lockdown starts and vice versa, because it was such a crazy period anyway, even without having this unfolding in the middle of it.
Were you with him when he died?
No, we thought we might be. We made a mad dash for the final farewells, and then, in typical fashion, he rallied the next morning and had another 2 or 3 days, and so we'd all done our, you know, our big farewells and what have you, without being 100% sure he would have heard. And my oldest, his goddaughter, came in to see him when we were saying our farewells, and I don't know why, but I know, I can't remember whether his grip on my hand tightened or whether, but he knew, and I knew that he knew, that he was still there. And I think by the time he finally left, we were all very comforted by confidence that he knew and he'd heard us say what we wanted to say to him before he went.
So hard. It's just so hard. It's just, very sad. I was just wondering, did you sort of have to go to work? Did you have to go straight back into talking and politics and lockdown and all that?
But you know, the weirdest thing about my job is that you can, even if you're in physical pain, you can turn it off for 3 hours, whether it's the adrenaline or whether it's the I talked about him on the radio a lot as well. I did a lot of fundraising for hospices. He'd loved the... So he put out a face... One of the last things he did on Facebook was an appeal for us to donate to the hospice workers that come to your house.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Rather than... So every time I said I told you so on the radio in the context of Brexit, I had a bit of theatre where I'd put £10 in a charity tin. And the charity was Hospices UK. And I know he'd have found that very, very funny. That was really near the end, actually. So I could talk about it on the radio. And then in the run-up to Christmas, his youngest was supposed to get a skateboard ramp for Christmas. And they got a message on about the 22nd or the 23rd. And remember, his dad's died by now, just to say that, oh, sorry, we won't be able to deliver it. And that was the last big... Christmas, Santa will bring you this, and he'd spoken to his boy about what Father Christmas was going to bring him, and this company ballsed it up. So I used my radio show to get a bloody skateboard ramp delivered. So it ended up being a pop star called James, who's a pal of mine anyway, but he was listening that day. James McVeigh out of the Vamps was listening in his car, and him being young and trendy had a lot much better contacts in the world of skate parks than I would ever have, and he made some calls, and it ended up with Andy's brother-in-law driving to meet the fella who'd built us a skate ramp overnight halfway from London, in all in the middle of lockdown, so that on Christmas morning his son could actually, you know, walk out into the garden, and there it was, this bloody great enormous skate ramp. And I used my show, so I'm very lucky at work in that I can always talk. I can talk about whatever I want to talk about. So I talked about my friend, and you know, I talked about my dad when he died. There's only one or two things in the course of my broadcasting career that I have left off limits on the radio show, and so no, I didn't have a problem with that. I was lucky. And then of course the Christmas, it coincided, so I had the Christmas break anyway. So I don't know. Well, I was processing my own grief, how interesting it would have been for other listeners to be in on that. Even if I did it on air, I didn't have to, because I was on my Christmas holidays anyway. But no, it's always quite... If I wanted to forget about it for 3 hours, I would have been able to, but by using the work. And equally, if I wanted to talk about it on the radio, I could do as well. So I'm very blessed like that, very lucky that they let me, you know, I'm allowed to have all that freedom on air, which is quite rare in this industry.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I guess also the interesting, your show and what you do, because it's, if you are sad that day, that's okay. That's not like someone reading the news and being like, oh, all right, like they're crying about something else. I just need them to tell me the news. Like,
yes,
it's not
I think
that.
You're right. Yeah, I mean, I don't think you could do it every day. There's those great stories about Tony Blackburn many, many years ago when his marriage broke down and he was begging his ex-wife to come back to him on air every day. I think there's probably a limit to how much of your inner turmoil you can bring to the microphone. But but I don't think I came close to crossing that line. And I know, and he listened a lot as well, particularly when he was, you know, bedbound. So some days I think, yeah, talking to you today, I tell you what did happen. What was really amazing was when we were discussing it. It was an Extinction Rebellion protest, and he had chemo that day. And so some of the kind of, I don't know what you'd call them, climate change skeptics would often, and I've heard it employed many times, use the argument about how awful Extinction Rebellion are, because what if someone needed to get to hospital and there was a protest, and he was in the back of a car, he was stuck in traffic going to chemo, stuck because of the Extinction Rebellion. I'm on the radio, I get a text off him while I'm in the studio saying, just so you know, I am actually on the way to chemo at the moment, and I might miss it because of this Extinction Rebellion protest, and I think it's the most important thing. I think the Extinction Rebellion protest is a hell of a lot more important than my chemo. And so I always had that idea that he might be listening in the background, and that, you know, was a very So I said that on air, actually, because I thought, well, he's obviously got me on in the car, so I might as well give him a little shout out. And I think people probably didn't believe me. It was too convenient. Oh, yeah, of course you have. You've got a mate in the back of the car on his way to keep. You know, goes to another school, does he?
Perfect.
But no, that, I'd forgotten about that. So that was the kind of input, you know.
That's a wonderful story. Because, you know, we have heard that argument so many times, and it's such a sort of blunt argument, because it's just like, well, yes, that might happen, but equally a bus could fall over because an alien hit it, and then people wouldn't be able to get to chemo. Like, there's so many reasons that people can't get to chemo. Like, things can happen. But yeah, how wonderful that he was able to express no.
He was literally the example, the living breathing example, and refuting what people were claiming on his behalf. Which of course isn't to say there'd have been someone else stuck in traffic who was having exactly the opposite reaction.
But
I just thought it was rather lovely that he was so on the money, he was so in the moment.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd. And so you talked a little bit earlier, we just come back to it, of like, you know, you were the same age, and obviously when somebody youngish dies, you know, that there is that moment where you think about your own mortality. And we had an episode a few weeks ago, a friend of mine passed away, a palliative care nurse, who, like, similar to what you're saying, like, I didn't quite realize the place she had in my life, and she was someone that I could talk to about this death stuff, which obviously a lot of my comedy friends don't really want to, like, get into, like, the nitty gritty of, like, palliative hospice care. And she was someone that really, really shook me, because to me she was so she was so young and youthful. And I, when we talked about her on that episode, I described her as someone, like, I wasn't kind of worried about. It wasn't in my list of, like, frail or vulnerable or anything like that. And it does make you question yourself and everything. So how have you dealt with that sort of aspect of grief, that which is kind of strangely, you know, could come back again to another point you made of, like, it is kind of more involved in yourself, but of course it is, because that's what grief does. You can't help but then reflect it back. Like, how are you feeling about your own mortality now that you've been through that?
Well, I bought a rowing machine. I'd already bought it. I bought it during lockdown, but I bought it for one of my children. And then my blood pressure was a bit high just after Christmas. So I have, for the first time in my life, I've started exercising. So I don't know. It's hard to unravel it.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It's hard to know whether it's linked or not. But I am increasingly... I interviewed Eric Cantona a few years ago. And it was a fascinating interview.
Yeah.
But he looked me in the eye. I was talking to him about mortality and getting older as an athlete, as a sportsman. And he looked me in the eye and he told me that he didn't believe he was ever going to die. And I kind of believed him. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's Eric Cantona, so it's all imbued with this slightly magical aura anyway. I mean, the man is almost a myth, isn't he?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I think he meant it. I think he kind of, rather than actually go there and think about it, he kind of, I do not think that I will die. I do not think I will die. And I know that I will now. I probably would have somehow subconsciously denied it this time last year. And so for the first time ever, I used to get so bored exercising and I talked myself out of it. And 3 months in, I'm still on it. So I guess that's probably part of it, is that making efforts to extend my own existence, you know. There might be grandchildren around one day. There's certainly children, people I want to see grow up, his children. I had one of his boys round last Saturday, not the one that's just gone, the one before, and it was, I missed him so much that day, but he's not really ready to talk about his dad yet much, but I need to be there for when he is, you see. And the fact that he was so comfortable in our family is something that you have to work at. You know, you can't take that for granted. If there's a 6 month gap between the next time we see him, then he might not be comfortable with my wife and me and my children. He might, you know, he might be feel like a stranger or an outsider. So there's so much that you think about. But it's made me more aware of time in every sense. Just, you know, the time you need to put into people, but also the time that you have being finite. It's a funny one. And again, it's all underpinned with the knowledge of what he'd make about... If I said to him, mate, I'm doing a podcast this afternoon, I'm going to really put it out there and examine how much I miss you and talk about grief, he'd get it. But he'd also be able to find it funny.
Yeah.
But that's the bit I can't quite convey to you, is that he would have this incredible ability to understand the seriousness of situations without ever taking situations too seriously. And I keep coming back to how much I wish I'd realised that at the time, and how much I wish I'd realised... So when I was writing the eulogy, which was awful, I mean, I love public speaking, and he hated it. And yet he ended up doing, you know, massive Silicon Valley rooms full of Silicon Valley billionaires and doing the whole TED Talk type of circuit. And yet he hated public speaking, so he trained himself to like it, whereas I always liked standing up in public and shooting my mouth off. But this was the one time I really didn't want to. I really didn't want to. And when I was writing it, I had some of the letters he's left for his children, and he said one thing in it. He said, I don't have a single regret. And that has really, I don't want to say haunted, because that has negative connotations, that's really, really stayed with me. It's imagine that. He actually said, imagine that. Imagine how that feels. 50 years on this earth and not a single regret about anything he'd ever done, any decisions he'd ever made.
Wow.
You know, from the big ones like getting married and adopting children and business stuff and doing this and taking risks and jumping out of metaphorical aeroplanes, and that has really stayed with me. I'd love to be able to say that when my time comes. It may already be too late, I don't know, but that was an incredible, because he meant it. You know, that initial reaction you have, like you think, and he'd already gone by the time I was going through this paperwork. So the idea that he was trying to do what I used to do, like kid himself almost that he was okay with this, convince himself almost that he wasn't broken, or I categorically, I would die on this bridge. He was at peace when he passed, and he genuinely looked back over his entire life and just felt joy and gratitude for what he'd been through, which I still don't understand, because he seemed to have got past any place where it was all regret or all pity, self-pity about what wouldn't happen. He genuinely got there. It was all about how lucky he felt he was, while I'm reading this thinking, on one level, I'm thinking he's the unluckiest person I know because he's not here anymore. And yet he's describing his great love for his wife, his great joy that he's taken from fatherhood. And I just believed him. And those were the bit, when I get to those bits, when I was doing the eulogy, I had to, let's just say I had to pause. Those, even in a relatively small congregation, that nearly got me, very, very nearly got me, because it was true, I think. And that's incredible, isn't it? I don't know how many people have that, especially when they're taken from us early. So I feel more keenly, maybe, than he did at the end, the things he'll never do, because he was so busy being grateful for the things that he did do.
I think that's incredible.
Yeah.
I think that's really incredible.
He was an incredible man, and he was more incredible in death, maybe, even more incredible in death than he had been in life, because he just took it, dealt with it, prepared for it, and went.
You know, we talk on the show sometimes and we'll say, like, a good death. But often what that's describing is, like, you know, someone being old or surrounded by family, or, you know, like, not being in loads of pain. But actually what I was just thinking of, like, it's almost like a good pre-death of, like, being able to reach a peace before you go, so that those that love you know that. Because I think that's the other thing that often happens to people is they just can't get, like, they can't get to that bit, that kind of zen-like state, because they're dealing with, no, I don't want to go, I don't want this. And that's amazing that he was able to get there, because I think what that really, the gift that is for those that you leave behind. Yeah. You know, that's why it's such a, like, I think maybe that's why we're both kind of silenced by it, because it's like, it's such a genuinely generous thing to do.
It's very hard to believe, isn't it? It's hard to fully believe. There's a little bit of you that thinks, yeah, all right, I mean, you're almost there, but you must still, and I'm sure that there would still have been howling at the moon moments of that. But I know that I read what he wrote, and I know he was ready. He had a long time to come to terms with it. I mean, so when my dad died, it was the polar opposite. He was 73. Right. No one was expecting it. He wasn't poorly. He just keeled over one day. And the only comfort I could drew immediately was the knowledge that we'd always been I'd always been a very expressive person. So Dad died, he could have been in no doubt whatsoever about how much I loved him. But there was there was none of that opportunity for him to be at peace. So that's what I get upset when I think about, wondering what was going through his mind at the end, because so much of it would have been shock and not being ready. He was a religious man, so I hope that there was some comfort in his religion at the end. But with Andy, he had so long to prepare for it, more than any of us thought that he'd have.
Yeah.
That I think he really used that time, which is, I don't know what's better or worse. What would you prefer? I mean, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Would you want a lightning bolt to come out of the sky and just end it all? Or would you want the opportunity to say your goodbyes and to put together your keepsakes and to share your memory? I just don't know, to be honest with you. No. But I do know that he was ready. He was at peace. He was at peace. I know that's an overused phrase, but there's a reason it's an overused phrase, isn't there? Because it just encapsulates something that other words don't quite describe. He was at peace, and I think that's why when he slipped away, we all knew it was coming. And because he was at peace, it was easier for us to deal with, obviously, than it would have been if we'd felt that he still was railing against the inevitable, you know?
Yeah.
He'd accepted the inevitable, and that made it much easier for us.
And that's why I think it's such a generous thing. And maybe, like, comes back to what you're saying about, like, it's a complete lack of ego, because it's really, it's an act, even though obviously it's, you know, you would want to be at peace. One would want to be at peace, but it's soothing to the people around you to be like, don't worry, I have dealt with this. You don't need to panic. Like, I'm okay. It's a very, very generous act to do, and not easy. Like, my God, not easy at all. And people can have all the time in the world. I mean, we do have all the time. The moment we're born, this is going to happen. And people still don't, you know, find their peace with a lot of things.
No.
And we talk about that a lot on the show of like, it's funny, like, so I speak to people who've had the sudden, you know, get a phone call, yes, in the middle of the night, someone's just died.
Yeah.
And then the people who've cared and nursed someone. And I think if you haven't been through one of the other experiences, you can often think, oh, that sounds better. But
yeah,
it's like comparing to, is to, you know, there's not about better or worse. It's just different. Like, they're both painful. One is, like you said, just wrapped up in shock. And the other is wrapped up in watching someone you love be in a lot of pain and be very sick, which is, you know, another, just a different form of pain. So I think if you can find anything good or anything, not good is, again, the wrong word, but anything
comforting,
consoling in that, then that is something, because it's such a sadness when somebody dies. It is such a sadness. And there's, you know, there's nothing we can do about that. That's, again, what so much of grief is ourselves railing against
the powerlessness,
the lack of control. There's nothing we can do. And for him to sort of lead by that example, I think that's really incredible that he found a peace. So therefore he's sort of leaving you with that gift of, well, I found a peace with it. So, you know, which obviously not to dictate how anyone feels. And I thought what you said about his son was really interesting as somebody who lost a parent as a teenager. People often ask me, oh, what can we do? What can we do? And I'm like, be there for the long term. Because that's what people don't realise. Like, and what you said was so heartwarming and beautiful to say, well, you know, look, he's at home now, but we have to keep making that effort because... like, my experience is, people didn't. And then kids are so sensitive, you know, we pick up on such those little things, that if you see that someone continued makes the effort, like, not just for a year, for like 10 years, for 50, if you like, as a parent would, it is just it's really, really special and important, because
it's important to hear that.
Yeah,
my wife is probably even better. My wife is a lot better than I am at that kind of thing. But it hit me last Saturday. It hit me. Christ, well, this needs to be part of his inner life. We need to be part of his emotional and mental furniture.
Yeah,
for the duration. Aren't we doing a great job of helping him during this difficult time? We need to be part of his emotional furniture, and we will be. We have to.
And
be.
You know, grief is a really, it doesn't go away. It stays with you for life, and you just learn how to deal with it. But if it happens to you very young, obviously it's formative. It changes a lot of things. And I know from my experience of people sort of turning up for the things they kind of felt they were supposed to turn up, and then trying to talk to you, and you were like, you're like a teacher to me. Like, you know, like, you suddenly want this bond, but you might as well be my geography teacher. Like,
so
I don't know you.
It's so interesting.
And they expect this connection from you because they had it with your parent. And you're like, you weren't there, you know, like the Saturdays when we had nothing to do because, like, you know, no one had invited us round or stuff like that. You know, the little things, that boring mundanity is like, that's when you need people there, you know. Like, not just, like you said, for the big moments.
Which is not... No, well, and I'm a bit... I can be a bit of a dick like that. I can be... I want the, you know, the plaudits for... Oh, wow, what an amazing, sensitive godfather. Wow, what an amazing... And you're, I love the way that you just use the word mundane, because that is what you need to be. You don't just get the, oh, isn't he great? Look at that. He's really looking after that boy. He's like, what a great bloke James is. Yeah, what a top lad. You need to be the boring...
The boring stuff, the rainy, you know, Saturday when there's nothing else to do, but
it
know
was bizarrely last time we saw him, it was a very rainy Saturday where there was nothing else to do, but that I mean, that is that, again, that's probably something I got out of therapy, was not seeing everything through the lens of my own self-importance, but just recognizing the role that you have to play in the life of people you love, and that is about them. the most valuable role you can play in the life of people you love is the role that they want you to play,
mm.
not the role that you feel most suited to or most drawn to.
Yeah, and it's hard, you know, it's hard. We all have our egos. We all have our things that we're more comfortable with. And again, it's like, if you're someone, like you said, who, you know, can do public speaking, is there for the big things. Mm. Like, that's great too. That's also lovely to have someone there who's good at that stuff. But yeah, I think often people forget or sort of think, oh, they probably don't need us for that. They'll be fine. And you're like, no, they are wondering where you are. Like, they are like, oh. And you lose, you know, when a parent dies, you sort of do lose a lot of friends, you know, as in people who used to come to the house, you know, your parents' friends, yeah. like people who just used to sort of pop round, like suddenly don't pop round because, you know, you realise, oh, when you're a kid, you just think they're my parents' friends. But as you get older, you go, oh, they were my dad's friend. They were my mum's friend. I didn't realise there was this thing that they're not going to come round because it would be odd to call that person. So, yeah, I think what you said was really wonderful. It's just a lot, isn't it? It's just a lot to process. Yes. And I think if somebody can give such generosity when they are dying... But equally, like, it's shit, isn't it? Because if someone's so great, of course you then miss them fucking more because you're like, they were great. They were really great.
That's the bit I've struggled with this year is that exactly that. The oh, man, we could have done this and we could have done that and we should have done that and we should have done the other. And I wish I'd known. I mean, partly the work side of stuff. I wish I'd known better what a player you were. Mm. Maybe because we talked about doing stuff together and neither of us ever quite got around to it or have it. I mean, that would have been great fun. So yeah, the bigger the gap, the bigger the regrets, but also the bigger the gratitude for having had that gap filled for so long, I think.
Yeah, and that, I think, comes back to what you're saying, when it is someone, you know, in your peer group or your age, you didn't quite see, it wasn't on the list. That's definitely how I felt about, I said, my friend who passed away. And
yes.
And when I attended her Zoom funeral and people started talking about, like, how incredible she was at her job. And I had no... Because, you know, she was my friend, the palliative care nurse that I talked to about death. And then all these people, like, how groundbreaking the work she was doing. And I was like, oh, my God. Like, yeah. I had no idea. Like, I knew she was good and knew she was interesting. And, yeah, I don't know what you do, you know... There's nothing you can do with that. Like you said, you can't fix it or be like, and so from now on, right. I'm going to like be friends, make sure I understand everybody. It's like, it doesn't work like that. Life isn't that simple. It'd be nice if you could then suddenly...
I listen more. I think I listen more now. You know, that the show-off gene where everyone's an audience potentially. Mm. I think I've learned from him when he was alive and in death that people are a lot more interesting than you sometimes realise, even people you think you know. So that's helpful. I've been out a couple of times since, because obviously we've had the privations of lockdown, and I do find myself excited isn't quite the right word, but energised by the thought of listening to people. Again, where does lockdown end and grief start? I don't know. It's all inextricably linked, but I find the idea, if I'm meeting up with someone I like, I do oddly now notice myself looking forward to finding out what they've been up to and how they've been. Like, genuinely looking forward to fleshing out those bits of our friendship, whereas previously perhaps I'd have been looking forward to telling them about my latest bit of news or my latest, quotes, achievement, end quotes. And being interested in theirs, but not interested enough. So that talking to you now, I realise that has actually shifted. Something has shifted there, but again, who knows whether it would have done anyway or whether it's linked to lockdown or whether it's linked to losing Andy.
Yeah, and it's hard because it was so recent as well. You know, like, it was only just, like you said, months ago. And I think grief and the relationship you have with that person that kind of internally carries on, those conversations carry on even though they're not there, because you sort of know what they might say to you about things like that, takes... Yeah, for you to like know where it's coming from, like you said, it's so fresh and so inextricably linked with what we've been going through. And I think I just say, like, I really understand where you're coming from, because, like, as a performer, which you are, you know, you are a form of performance, I guess, isn't it? And I think when you've come from a performer background, it takes a lot. Like, it takes a lot and a lot of adrenaline and a lot of push and drive to get anything, because it's so hard to get somewhere. And then what I've noticed with all my friends as well, like, we pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed, and sometimes you have to sort of slow down and go, oh, I don't need to keep doing that. But you're still in that mindset of like, gotta break down the door because I'm not going to get there. And I think you really get that sense with you and Andy of like, he saw you in those bits when you were still pushing, so of course he was still delighted when it worked, and then was able to listen it was
lovely. I mean, so I remember, but when I became a published author, which my dad never saw, my dad would always use the old Peter Cook joke. If my career was in the doldrums, he'd say, what are you doing, son? And I'd say, I'm writing a book, Dad. And he'd say, neither am I, son, which is the old Peter Cook gag. And I finally got around to writing a book. And I honestly think that Andy found that even more exciting than I did. You know, he sent me pictures of him and my godson in Waterstones, or they just found it in the window. And I don't know that I've ever had a friend who could derive so much pleasure from other people's pleasure, from other people's success. I honestly don't. And then we come back to that Joni Mitchell line about not knowing what you've got till it's gone, which is the most poignant thing of all, isn't it? Because you're 50% lucky and you're 50% regretful. But he wasn't the kind of guy that wanted me to, you know, write a bloody poem about what a top mate he was. That would have been that would not have been his idea of fun. He just had that. He had an ability, I think, due to his mum, who he also lost early-ish. I mean, he was in his, I think, his early 40s when he lost his mum. But he dealt with that loss, and I realised when I was thinking about him and his life, what an enormous part, and also when I was reading what he'd written about his life, what an enormous part his mum had played. And he talked to my wife about his parents split up when he was quite young, and he stayed with his mum, and she'd come in from work, she worked in Boots in Rochdale, and she'd come in and they'd sit in the kitchen and they could talk about absolutely anything. So although I've got this image of him as a buttoned up northerner who wouldn't have wanted me to write, but he clearly, in that kitchen in the 80s and the 90s with his mum, he clearly did the emotional literacy. He clearly talked about everything and brought that to his friendships and his relationships. So sometimes you don't need to say it out, just to feel seen. That was it. That was the thing with him, is that he saw you. And he saw almost all of you, which very few people do. Often the people who love you the most perhaps are blind to your faults. But he just saw you. You felt so seen with him. And that, again, is where the gap, the hole in my life feels biggest, because it's a very rare feeling to feel completely seen.
Yeah. Oh, God.
And
he brought that. And like you said, it's precious and wonderful, and so wonderful when it happens, but of course, like all wonderful things, when it's gone, there's a pain to that. And I think, yeah, especially I can really relate to that of like you said, the industry you're in, and maybe that's not fair, maybe everybody has that feeling of needing and enjoying someone who just, like you said, can see everything and is not judging you for it, but just is be like, yeah, I know your worst, I know your best, and I still think you're fine. Like, that's a very nice place to be with someone.
Yeah, and almost liking your faults as well.
Yeah.
Because they're part of you, and, you know, it's very strange, as I said at the outset, I think because of age, not expecting it to happen, and to reflect on the luck, actually, the good fortune of having someone like that in your life, which is almost counterintuitive when you're mourning them, to be reflecting on how lucky you were to have them, because you don't have them anymore. So the luckier you were to have them, the sadder you should be that you don't have them. And yet he somehow managed to navigate that. The better your life is, the angrier you should be about it ending early, right? You'd think. And the more amazing your friend is, the madder you should be about him being taken away early. And yet, somehow, almost by a process of emotional osmosis, I think I took away from his peace. I think I took away some of my own. That idea, I was just really, really lucky to know you. And yeah, it would have been great to know you for another 30 years. But I won't. And I can't. So I'll just sit with how lucky I was to know you, and I think that that's what he'd done as well. You'd be great to live for another 20 or 30 years, but Jesus, I've had a life. Mm. And I know that he went to, you know, he went to his maker feeling like one of the luckiest people that ever lived. And that's a really beautiful, comforting consolation. He just did. And he was, you know, in many ways. But it wasn't just luck. It was a special human being.
Well, James, thank you so much for talking to us about Andy. He sounds bloody brilliant.
I wish you could meet him. I really do.
Yeah, me too. He sounded lovely. And what an amazing thing to deal with something like that.
I mean, that's the takeaway. Mm. I wish I could remember it word for word, but I honestly don't have a single regret. Can you imagine what that feels like? And I'm not sure I can, but he could. He was there.
Well, yeah. And thank you for coming and remembering him today.
Thank you.
James's book, How Not to Be Wrong, The Art of Changing Your Mind, is out in paperback now, available from all good bookshops. You can hear him most days on LBC, and he's also available to follow on Twitter at Mr. James OB, MRJAMESOB. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was recorded remotely from my living room and I think an LBC studio where James had just finished his shift of talking to people. It's edited by Kate Holland and the music was provided by The Glue Ensemble. And remember, you are not alone. And good luck this Sunday. Remember, it's just a day, and once it's over, you don't have to think about it for a year.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.